We begin with Boeing. The FAA is under increasing pressure to ground all 737 MAX 8s after last weekend's crash in Ethiopia. The longer we go without a definitive cause for that crash, the greater the pressure. CBS senior travel editor Peter Greenberg joins us live this morning. Good morning, Peter.
And good morning.
What are you hearing from passengers this week? Because the officials say nothing to worry about, at least in the U.S., but passengers are wary.
They are. The optics are not good. Most passengers don't make the distinction between a 737 MAX 8 and a 737. Most people don't really question the kind of plane they're flying on. But right now, just the words 737 is enough to give people some pause. You're seeing a number of passengers calling airlines trying to either change their reservations or cancel existing reservations. And that number is just growing. You take an airline like Southwest Airlines, which flies nothing but the 737. Now, in their entire fleet of over 600 planes, only 30 of them are the new MAX jets. But people are not making that distinction. And while the FAA has not officially grounded the planes, what you're seeing in countries around the world, from the United Kingdom to China to South Korea to many Caribbean countries that are banning the 737 MAX from their airspace, it's only a matter of time before they will effectively be grounded in this country, pending further investigation.
So you do think the FAA will eventually say, okay, the MAX 8s, you're not going to fly those right now?
Well, you used the right word there, eventually. The FAA has always been historically reluctant to ground any kind of aircraft, because when the FAA was actually put into service in 1935 by an act of the U.S. Congress, it was given a schizophrenic mandate to enforce and regulate aviation safety policy and then to promote the business of aviation. You can't do both. And what the FAA has always had to come to grips with, and not successfully, I might add, is who they're serving, the American public or the business of aviation. Think about this. They've only grounded three different aircraft types since they were started. It was the Comet in the late 50s and early 60s. It was the DC-10 in 1979, following the worst aviation crash in American history to this date, back in Chicago. And then most recently, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, after a series of battery fires on the cargo hold, the most recent one being in Boston. That's it. So they're under a lot of pressure now to do it. Congress, a lot of Congress people are asking them to do it. A number of unions are asking them to do it. But so far, they have not done it.
And tell me, because there is a striking similarity between the Lion Air and then this crash out of Ethiopia with the 737 MAX 8. I know we don't know the definitive cause of the latest crash, but odd similarities in how they went down. And we're discovering that two captains had actually filed some complaints with the FAA about the manuals that describe how to operate this MAX 8 system. Where can we connect the dots here with warnings from captains, similarities in how these two went down? Or are we reading too much into it?
Actually, this time, I don't think we are. You know, the FAA has an anonymous safety reporting system where pilots can, without giving their names, right in with concerns about safety issues. And there were a number of pilots, not just two of them, a number of pilots writing in about this particular software system on the 737 MAX. And you talk about odd similarities. Let me give you some good news. We've just celebrated 10 years of the safest period of commercial aviation safety since aviation began. We've only had one fatal accident. That was back in February of 2009 with Colgan Air near Buffalo. Mm-hmm. So to have two brand new aircraft within a span of 6 months crash in remarkably similar situations, this is disturbing.
Yeah, certainly is. So are people overreacting if they opt to not fly on a 737 MAX 8 right now?
Well, you know what? I can't make that assessment. What I can say is that the optics are such that people are operating either out of an abundance of caution or out of an abundance of fear. And until we know the exact cause of this, of these two crashes, that emotion is probably going to be very, very strong and will remain.
That is CBS senior travel editor Peter Greenberg on the latest with Boeing and the 737 MAX 8s. Thanks so much, Peter.
You got it.
It's time for our weekly chat with historian Felix Bunnell. Got a good mystery on our hands. It's the story of a mother who never gave up searching for her son after his Navy plane disappeared from the old Sandpoint Naval Air Station on Lake Washington. What do you mean disappeared?
Well, I mean, this is another plane crash story, and I acknowledge a certain obsession with this topic. We've done this
personally,
many times. Yeah.
Okay.
Over the years here on these history pieces, they often come back to plane crashes. And my interest isn't morbid. It's not about the destruction or the loss of life. It's really about the resilience of the human spirit and how survivors of tragedies or the loved ones who are left behind, you know, somehow adapt and carry on. And really, this particular story is about a mother's love. So it was 70 years ago this past Monday, two naval aviators, 23-year-old Gaston Mays, 25-year-old Benjamin Vreeland, took off on a routine flight in an SNJ-5 trainer. That's a World War II-era single-engine Navy plane. They left from Sandpoint over on Lake Washington, what's now Magnuson Park.
Vreeland and Mays were scheduled to go out for a flight March the 11th, and they took off about 10 o'clock in the morning and headed east towards the Cascades. And apparently at some point, they had engine problems.
That's Lee Corbin. He's a retired pilot and aviation history enthusiast. He's a great friend of the show. He's become a friend of mine. He spends a lot of his time researching aviation history in all kinds of archives. He stumbled across this story several years ago. He read that once they knew the plane was likely down somewhere, the Navy searched for it and the pilots for about a week. They had no luck. But it wasn't really the crash or the official search that caught Lee Corbin's eye. It was what the mother of Gaston Mays, one of the pilots, did in the months and years after the Navy gave up.
Oh, it just fascinates me that Mays' mom, Nora Mays, would care about her son so much so that she would make the trip every year for 19 years out here from just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, to try and find him. And then she got so close, it seems like, based on the evidence. And then, you know, it just never happened. She never got the results she was hoping for.
Isn't that incredible? She came out for it's a total of 20 summers, 19 years in a row. The mother of the pilot, one of the pilots, Gaston Mays.
She passed and never...
Yeah, she died in 1983, but she came out here every year from 1949 to 1968. The first couple of years, her family came along, her husband, her other two kids, to do a search of their own. They drove logging roads and talked to lumberjacks. They visited small towns in the Snoqualmie Valley and truck stops. They handed out flyers that they'd made. They had a cash reward. So she came out here every year. And by the mid-1950s, you know, this is a huge search area that they were looking for, but by the mid-50s, the search was narrowed to something called Black Lake, which is in the foothills west of Snoqualmie Pass. Yeah. It's about 7 miles due east of Carnation. Because it turned out that not long after the crash, a forest ranger had seen the water in Black Lake change to the color of the dye packets in naval life jackets.
Oh.
It turned out loggers had reported hearing a plane in that area having engine trouble on the morning that the two guys disappeared. And then debris from the plane, possibly from the plane, had been found in the lake. So for several summers in the late 50s and early 60s, local scuba diving teams spent several days in Black Lake. They even borrowed a metal detector from White's Electronics down in Oregon. Metal was detected, but no conclusive debris or remains were ever found. So now Lee Corbin put me in touch with David Mays. David Mays is 63 and lives in South Carolina. Nora Mays was his grandmother. Gaston Mays was his dad's brother, the uncle he never met. David Mays told me why he thinks Nora Mays spent so many years searching for her son.
So Gaston was kind of, you know how that first child is in a group of three with children. He was kind of probably her favorite. And then he went down in the plane, and she just, as a mother, I don't think she ever got over that. And so she went looking every summer, and she would talk about it, and she'd share all the details with us, me and my brother, his grandchildren. And it was a topic she always spoke about every time we got together. I grew up 8 miles away from her, so we saw each other quite a bit. And it was always on her mind. She just never could get emotionally detached from it.
You know, and David Mays says his grandmother's focus on her lost son was hard on her other two kids, that's David's dad and David's aunt, and on his grandfather. He says that when he was a kid, he didn't really understand why his grandma never stopped searching. But once he had a son of his own, and once that son was in harm's way, it all made sense.
You know, there's no one black and white line for every life. And I want to be careful not to judge my grandmother too harshly. I had enough to answer for my own life. But, you know, 20 years every summer is that's an awful lot. But I know my son when he was in the Marine Corps, he'd been to Iraq and all these things. I thought over and over again, well, if he were to get captured or die, I'd be on the first plane to go after him.
Yeah, so David Mays has never been to Black Lake, but he's aware of Lee Corbin's research, and he's helped with it. He's also heard about a new search effort that's being organized by a guy named Sean Murphy that might happen as early as later this year. And I asked David Mays, you know, how's it going to feel if that search turns up definitive evidence?
Well, I'd be on the next plane. Yeah, I'd want to be a part of that.
So it's out there somewhere, the wilderness of Washington.
Yeah, and the technology is better than it was when they last dove on this lake, which was more than 50 years ago.
They really do believe it's this lake.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many bits of evidence that point to it, but they've never found anything definitive. But there's better technology now. There's, you know, better ability to sort of pierce through the darkness and the murk and everything. So if anybody has a chance of finding it, we certainly have a better chance than they had 50 years ago.
And I know you'll update us if something
happens. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
and it's tantalizing in that the notion of closure for this one family is pretty intense. Over the other, we don't know much about the other guy's family, but it's a fascinating story.
I keep thinking about that poor mother. Having passed, not knowing what happened to her son. That's the worst.
Yeah, but she made lots of friends when she came out here every year for 20 years. They have letters in the collection that show that people really liked her, and she really sort of made this sort of almost like a second home.
And the search continues because of
Absolutely.
Her. So, all right, thank you. Felix Bunnell, our resident historian. We talk to him every week at this time.
Cattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. When you go on to buy something, you might have noticed that there's another option there besides PayPal and the traditional charge cards. There's an option called Afterpay. And Afterpay allows you to pay for an item in installments, four equal installments over time, without paying any interest. And this would apply to anything on the website. So what's behind it? Turns out this is an Australian company, so we have called up James Ayers, who writes about it for the Australian Financial Review in Sydney. So what is the attraction of this? What makes this so appealing to so many people? Because it seems to be spreading pretty quickly around the country here.
It is spreading very quickly, and I've been following the company for a couple of years now. It's now broadening its horizon into other areas of retail and shopping. But at its heart, it was able to attract female shoppers who were really able to use the service to buy shoes or a dress, something that might be a little bit outside the normal weekly spending, but they're able to spread that payment over 4 to 6 weeks and not pay any interest, as you said. And what is different about the business model is that they've shifted the cost of providing the payment service across to the retailers. Now, retailers have always paid interchange fees for credit cards. Afterpay, they charge the retailer a much larger fee. In Australia, it averages around 4% of the costs of goods sold. Now, why would they want to pay?
Right. What's the advantage for the retailer? Because the credit cards are sort of the same deal, right? And cheaper to the retailer. So why would they want to take advantage of this service?
Well, look, it's a good question. And at the moment, many are willing to pay that amount. Part of it is a sort of a fear of missing out. Once the retailers know that the retailer next door is starting to offer this service, then they've had to offer it as well. Effectively, the retailers have been saying to us that it has been genuinely customer-led. They've had customers coming back through their feedback channels in their stores saying, why aren't you offering Afterpay? We want to pay with Afterpay. But you've also have Afterpay creating a, you know platform economics very well, your listeners in Seattle with Amazon and the US giant technology companies that have created platform retailing models around the world. Afterpay's got a group of millennial customers that are coming to its app in order to determine where to shop.
So this is a way that, so in other words, this might be a whole market that some retailers haven't been able to crack because it involves millennials who may not want credit cards at all and wouldn't buy the merchandise unless they had a deal like this, which didn't charge them any interest.
A bit of both. It appears that the millennials don't like credit cards as much as older generations do. We've looked at the credit card data, and it is on the wane in Australia for younger cohorts, and debit cards on the way up. Now, 85% of Afterpay accounts in Australia are linked to the debit card. So from the retailer's perspective, if those additional sales that they otherwise wouldn't be able to achieve are being driven to them, then perhaps they're, look, at least for the moment, willing to pay the 4% fee.
Mm. Now, we haven't talked about the stick. We've talked about the carrot. What is the stick if you don't pay?
If you don't pay, you're hit with a late fee. Now, the fee, I think, is a $10 flat fee if you're late, and then another of $7 every week. It's capped at 25% of the cost of the goods. Now, Afterpay needed to introduce caps relatively recently after there was some regulatory backlash, and this is sort of an ongoing issue in Australia. There was a sense that some vulnerable customers, those that might not necessarily be able to receive credit from a bank or be able to get a credit card, were able to quite quickly and easily onboard to the service and spend beyond their means.
Was this turning into like another form of payday lending?
There were concerns that it might be some sort of version of that. And there are plenty of skeptical analysts in the Australian market suggesting that it is that, that it is some form of predatory lending, and that they're targeting people who can't afford to repay. So what has happened is two things. Afterpay has had to do some self-regulation, and it's also having to consider how much checking it does of the customer. It only takes a couple of minutes to get onto the app, and you've got $100 or $200 to spend. Unlike a credit card where you can build up quite a large debt and revolve that debt and continue to spend and let that debt get bigger and bigger and bigger and just pay off the interest payment and continue to use the card up to the limit. Afterpay will only let you use the service while you're up to date with all your payments. So if you can't use the service to do anything more, you're fettered from the app and you won't be let back on until you're on time at all. So they say that limits the potential for people to spiral into some kind of debt trap.
I see. Well, that sounds fair. The penalty is we kick you off the service. You abused it, so we kick you off. We don't take your house. We don't take your car. But you can't use the service anymore. Well, that's the story behind Afterpay, a new way to pay for stuff. And so now when you see that pop up on your website, you'll know what it's about. James Ayers reports for the Australian Financial Review in Sydney. James, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah Scott. She knows everything that's going on, and a lot happened. I was watching your Twitter feed. If you want to follow Hannah on Twitter, it's at Hannah Cairo FM, and she gives you all the juicy dirt coming out of Olympia.
Well, and it's been, there's again, been a flurry of activity because today at 5 p.m. is the cutoff period for the House and Senate to pass their own bills out of their chambers. So they're passing bills late in the evenings. It was, again, I think 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock by the time they stopped in the Senate last night. A big bill that came out, though, was presidential candidates who want to be on our state's ballot would have to release their tax returns under a bill that cleared the Senate. This one from Democratic Senator Patty Cooterer.
Although releasing tax returns has been the norm for about the last 40 years, in presidential elections, unfortunately, we've seen that norm broken. And we live in an era where relying on norms alone is no longer a guarantee in the pursuit of power. And that is what's at the heart of this legislation. We are moving to codify a norm that has existed in our country for over 40 years so that we can be assured of information that we have come to expect and that we all agree is vital in making a decision on who should lead this country.
And so she points out dozens of other states have similar legislation or have already passed similar bills. And while she said that this, she mentioned President Trump refusing to release his tax returns on the floor debate, she insisted this was not aimed at any particular candidate.
And this isn't about a particular candidate. This isn't about whether it's Republican or Democrat. This is really about transparency, about giving people the information that they need in order to make a crucial decision. It's about transparency in our elections for our posterity's sake.
You said several other states have passed similar bills. This is post-President Trump taking office?
Yes.
Okay, because
yes.
How would they have him on?
Yes, yes, yes.
Have him get away with it. So clearly this is reactionary to the current president. No matter what she says.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the Republicans in the room definitely thought so. So here's what this bill does. It makes it mandates that every presidential candidate submit 5 years of tax returns if they want to be on our primary ballot or our presidential ballot. Republicans, as I said, not excited about this, as you might imagine, especially Doug Erickson, a senator and also former Trump administration staffer.
So this legislative body passes this bill. The attorney general tries to defend it. Let's just say perhaps he's successful after spending a few more million dollars that he's already spent compared on top of what he's already spent suing the federal government. And the Republicans decide we're going to go and use a caucus system and not the presidential choice primary to get a nominee. So the Republican Party picks a nominee through the caucus system. And that nominee is President Trump, for example. And he determines not to release his tax returns. So this legislative body is going to say that the Republicans will not have a choice on the November ballot, even after the Republican Party picks that person through their caucus system to be the nominee. I mean, I would think that would lead to a little bit of a revolt here in Washington State.
And it's arguments like that that have critics saying that this is going to lead to a court battle if it were to pass. So a lot of this has to still play out. But it did pass, again, along party lines. Also, just a quick side note, the presidential primary bill that we've talked about earlier as the session has been going on that bumps our presidential primary up to the second Tuesday in March, has passed and will be signed by the governor tomorrow. Just FYI.
So does that mean? No, it probably wouldn't. Nothing would happen this year. It would be next year.
It would be next year. Yeah. But, yeah.
Got it.
Absolutely. So also, all of you listeners and followers on Twitter, I know you're excited about the daylight saving year-round bills that have been moving through. So another big step forward on this yesterday. So we already talked over the weekend, the House version of the bill, which would keep us on year-round daylight savings time all year long, and stripped out the public vote option. That one passed over the weekend. And then last night, the Senate passed its own version, which did not originally have a public vote in it, but now it does. It passed with an amendment adding that to it. This one from Republican Senator Jim Honeyford.
This is a week that's very dangerous. With the time change, we find there's more auto accidents, more heart attacks, more strokes, and children don't do as well on tests in school. And so this will eliminate that time change.
So that passed, and overwhelming support, both the House version that passed and the Senate version that passed. But these are different. So what we have now is a House version that doesn't require a public vote, a Senate version that does require a public vote. I got a lot of questions on Twitter yesterday. What does that mean? What's going to happen with our bills? So each of the bills will now go to the other House or Senate, and they'll have to reconcile and come up with one before we get to the end of session. Marcus Uccelli, behind the House version of the bill that passed over the weekend, I talked to him last night after this one passed. He's just excited.
Kind of interesting now. My bill has passed the House, looks like the bill that Senator Honeyford introduced, and now his bill has passed the Senate, looks like the bill I introduced. And the referendum clause, again, I think was to show the strong support to our congressional delegation, but it's clear now with both chambers passing it that there's overwhelming support. And I think, you know, at this point, with the national interest, we should potentially skip the step. But, you know, I'm open to discussions, and I can see the value in both. And I just want to get a bill that moves us forward on this policy to the governor's desk. And I think we have a good shot.
And he's not wrong. Both chambers, they passed with maybe three to 10 no votes. It was an overwhelming passage, both in the House and the Senate. And there is a lot of national conversation going on about this. You saw after we talked about this earlier in the week, the president tweeted about that. He actually mentioned that to me, and he said he feels like there's really just a big national movement. So it's very likely that I think that this gets passed in our state legislature, and that we maybe see some congressional action.
Yes.
So we'll see.
To stay on the current time we're on now, we would need congressional action. If we were to adopt the time that happens in the fall, we could just do that. No congressional
action.
That's
right. Yes.
But both of the House and Senate bills for the state keep us on this time.
Right. And that is, again, because there were bills from, I think, both of them going at the start of the session that would have kept us on that standard time all year round. But they really both told me that they heard overwhelmingly from people, no, we want to stay with the extra daylight in the afternoons. That seems to be where all of the support is right now.
Blackout shade manufacturers are wringing their hands. We did it.
It remains to be seen whether there'll be a public vote on this. And so to be clear, the reason that the public vote is an issue, I have people ask me, you know, why do we even need this? Why do we need the legislature to pass it? And they do. It's a cost issue for one. And then some thought it would send a good message to Congress that we want this done. Now they say maybe we don't need that.
All right. So, I like all the action. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It is time now for your daily dose of kindness. It's always a good day when I can point out how social media can be used for good and not just a platform for ill-informed hot takes or tearing down strangers with whom you disagree. This is certainly the opposite of that. On Saturday, one tweet from a newly created Twitter account went viral. It said, "My dad is sad because no one is coming to his new donut shop," with an emoji crying face. With it, a picture of dad standing alone behind the counter of his Missouri City, Texas donut shop, surrounded by fresh donuts. And yes, he looks a bit sad. By Sunday afternoon, a day after that tweet, it had been retweeted more than 150,000 times. By Monday, 260,000 times. Putting that into perspective, according to The Uplift, that's the 30th most retweeted tweet in history. But more than that, the tweet about sad dad worked, and soon the donut shop had a line out the door.
Well, I saw it on Twitter, and we have family in town, and we came here for a visit, and we passed by, and we just came in.
I'm trying to find somewhere for breakfast, and my son said, "Mom, this is blowing up social media. We got to go here." Like, what is it? Billy's Donut Shop. And so I said, okay.
Even Twitter visited the donut shop. Employees from the social media giant came by. They bought out the store, so anyone who was in line got free donuts. And still today, the shop continues to sell out of donuts.
Very excited. Just speechless. about how many people came to support us.
And now, one of the more recent pictures on Billy's Donuts Twitter account, I'm happy to report, shows a smiling dad who is no longer sad. Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. It is Danny O'Neill. He's going to help me figure out why I could not decode all of the sports language I was observing on Twitter last night about Odell Beckham Jr.
So a trade happens, and it happened probably about between 5 and 6, or was it a little later than that? Maybe it was a little bit later than that.
It was right before bedtime for me, so it was about that time, yeah.
So there's a trade where the Giants trade Odell Beckham Jr., who's one of the better, one of the best wide receivers in the league, and he's a pretty flamboyant personality, strong personality.
Okay, so he rubs people the wrong way in some instances.
Sometimes.
Because what I couldn't decode is why, out of all the trades that we hear about, why this one was sparking such ferocious emotions in many directions, from, you know, enjoying him being traded or loathing him being traded. There was just such a strong reaction.
It's a great, what were the answers you found as you tried to figure out why was this such a lightning rod? Because it's been the biggest deal so far in free agency.
The only thing I could figure out is perhaps he's just the type of personality that brings that reaction out of people.
He's not Antonio Brown, though, who was traded from the Steelers to and sent to the Raiders, is a stronger personality, more polarizing.
My only other hypothesis is that the Browns are a really bad team, and so people are enjoying him being traded to a really bad team.
There's part of that. And then there's also the sheer panic of New Yorkers.
Oh.
This was why I would say that it is. I don't think the city of New York could get over itself if you gave it a grappling hook. It is obsessed with itself. Uh-huh. It thinks that everything's bigger than New York. So when one of their franchises does something that's kind of inexplicable, which this one's tough to justify, why you would trade one of the best players in football for two draft picks and okay safety.
Can you figure out why?
Yes, because they're rebuilding. Because they've decided we're going to tank. We are going to tank the 2019 season. And people like me, who think that the entire city of New York is insufferable, love the idea of all these New York Giant fans watching their blue blood franchise absolutely stink, suck on carbon monoxide for the entire season while they basically try to rebirth themselves and come back as the Phoenix. So maybe it's the enjoyment of that. Combine that with the fact that it's a documented fact that God hates Cleveland. God hates Cleveland.
Yeah, and so how does that play into
that? They've now assembled this massively talented. They've had maybe the most aggressive offseason of any team. They won 7 games last year. They look like they're about to turn the corner. But given the fact that God hates Cleveland, we know that this is going to go down in flames.
Oh, what, maybe injuries?
It could be injuries. It could be because they've got some guy who's never been a head coach before named Freddie Kitchens.
How does this
impact? Does Freddie Kitchens sound like a guy who can win a Super Bowl
Freddie
as a coach?
I kind of like that name.
Yeah,
to be
really?
Honest. Yeah.
Yeah, Freddie he's related to Tim Cupboards.
That was a cheap shot. Well, how does this impact the Seahawks, if at all?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And that's why I couldn't figure out. It was like, who cares? You know, a lot of local people were freaking out about it. And
it was also surprising. And in this day and age, usually you know trades are going to happen days and days ahead of time. Mm-hmm. The fact is that this one was pulled off without anybody knowing it was coming. So it was a true surprise. Mm-hmm. And social media plays into it. It's really fun for everybody to go on. My favorite is when NFL reporters will quote tweet someone else's report, and then they'll go, wow.
Wow, period.
It's like, that is really adding context to the entire situation.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
This is why I'm glad I have you to explain these type of things. It's not a trade, but J.R. Sweezy is leaving.
Yeah, I'm bummed about this. I'm really bummed. J.R. Sweezy's going to the Arizona Cardinals. Mm. And this will be the second time he's left the Seahawks for more money elsewhere. Yes, it is.
Oh,
and it's not great. And he came back last year and he was a pretty good player for them.
Yeah.
And he loved being back. And Seattle, this is not a case of J.R. Sweezy not liking it here. This is a case of Seattle not meeting the price that another team was willing to offer him. And so he goes within the division, and I'm bummed about that, in part because the one thing Seattle has shown is difficulty in finding rank-and-file offensive linemen.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that was one lesson that should have been learned over the past 4 to 5 years, is that maybe Seattle has undervalued continuity and veteran experience on the offensive line because they've been so willing to let guys go. And now you let him go, and I was like, unless this is a massive amount of money, I'm I'm surprised that that he wasn't more valuable to Seattle than he was to any other team.
They couldn't be making more room for Russell's new contract, could they?
Yeah, but they've got room to pay J.R. Sweezy and Russell Wilson. He's not a budget breaker. Unless this comes out, it's like a $6 or $7 million a year deal, and then I'll say, okay, I can see why you didn't go that high.
So what can you speculate anything about the direction the Seahawks are headed?
This is what they always do. They sit and stand pat. They are the least aggressive, one of the least aggressive teams in the NFL in free agency. And this year, every time this year, people start freaking out. They've lost five free agents to other teams and they haven't signed any. This is what always happens. And actually, I would say that's great news for Seattle overall, because the people that are being sold right now, do you know the buy it now button on eBay?
Oh, yeah.
Where all of a sudden, instead of being in the auction.
And on Amazon. Don't forget, Amazon's got to buy it now, too.
Well, but Amazon's not an auction site. Oh, and you have to see it as an auction. That's what free agency is okay. Can I get $5 million over here? We got $5 million over here. And this is the buy it now button. That's the guys that are going, and Seattle doesn't do that. They wait and kind of sift through after everything's been picked over, and they're like, this one looks pretty good. How about this price for that? And that's how they do it, and they've been really good at it.
All right.
They've been really good, so I have a lot of faith in them. I just wish they would have kept Sweezy.
I do like
it. It's not easy losing Sweezy.
It is. I hope he has fun playing in the Cardinals' stinky stadium.
Yeah. It's a house of horrors for the Seahawks.
Thank you, Danny.
Talk to you soon.
Good to have you with us on Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. I'm Colleen O'Brien. There are plenty of happy stories about people who find their families through home DNA tests. This is not one of those stories. Here's Rachel Bell.
Like millions of people curious about their genealogy, 61-year-old James Johnston bought a 23andMe DNA kit.
When it came back, I knew my ancestry didn't quite match. I should have been pretty much 100% British-Irish. But I had a lot of German-French ancestry. It just seems weird. It says I have a German great-grandparent, and there is just no way.
Finding out you're a different kind of white doesn't sound like a big deal. But James had spent years researching his family's genealogy, and this made him suspicious.
I was born when my mother was only 17 years old. My parents were married only 2 months before I was born. So I was kind of always a little suspicious, and I don't look like my brothers, and I didn't see anything of my dad in me. I asked my mom straight out over the years, I said, am I Robert Johnston's son? And she said, yes.
James bought a few more DNA kits. He asked his mom and brothers to give up a little bit of their saliva and sent the test back to the 23andMe lab. And when the results came back, it revealed that the brothers he grew up with were only his half-brothers. His mom admitted the dad that he grew up with was not actually his father.
She was only 16. She wasn't married. She got pregnant. Her boyfriend, who is my biological father, he joined the Air Force, and she wrote him a letter and said that she was pregnant. And I guess she never heard back from him. And she started going with somebody else who I thought was my biological father. And she married him 2 months before I was born. And they decided, my dad, who I thought was my dad, that they would never tell me. He knew that I wasn't his and that they would just keep that secret.
The man that James thought was his dad had passed away years before, so James felt comfortable tracking down his birth dad, and he found him. He's 80 years old and lives just 2 hours away.
Ironically, he ended up working in the same auto plant that I did. For 20 years, we worked in the same plant. He said he knew I was there, and he thought about having somebody point me out, but never happened. So I'm really kind of uneasy about the way he handled that.
Discovering that your dad is not really your dad when you're 61 years old is shocking and emotional. But James didn't expect his family to be so upset by the news.
My mother hasn't spoken to me since all this happened. So it was a secret she really didn't want revealed. And I tried to talk to her, and she just won't talk. My brother Mark told me that they see me as an ingrate. My stepdad kept saying, you think you got a raw deal? I said, no, I don't. But I was just thinking that I should have been told the truth for a lot of reasons, just because it's the right thing to do. There's also the medical history.
The decision to explore his DNA has caused a major rift between James and the only family he's ever known. And after spending a day with his birth father, he's not eager to nurture that relationship.
I just am uncomfortable with it. I don't know if it's a deep psychological scar or what, that he didn't seem to really show any interest in me until now. And I wish he just would have said, you know, I'm sorry that it worked out that way, and I'm sorry I should have handled it different. Maybe, you know, he never helped me in any way. He abandoned his his responsibilities to my mother and to me.
23andMe's senior product specialist, Lindsay Grove, told me they get a lot of calls and emails from people who have gotten shocking results.
So we do a lot of training on how to listen and be empathetic and really help the customer understand what they're seeing. We're not counselors, so what we really try to do is stick to the science behind the report, really explain what they're seeing and how we got to those results.
There were so many jaw-dropping twists and turns in that story, Rachel. I don't even know where to begin. Number one, poor guy.
The question is, you know, what is the moral commitment from 23andMe? Should there be some kind of warning that pops up like, hey, if you click on this button, because when you take the test, there's all these different things that you can look at. You can look at, you know, am I French? Am I English? And you never even have to click on who is related to me. There's a place where you can click on that.
How could you
but
not?
You know, you're going to do that.
Yeah.
And it's happening for a lot of people.
Yes.
Obviously, you usually know who your mother is because you came out of her, but it's the
right.
dad thing. And so many people are finding out that their dad isn't their dad. And that's a big deal to find out when you're just sitting at your computer or, you know, scrolling through your phone and aren't emotionally prepared for that. And so that's what I was talking to 23andMe about. Like, you know, do you guys offer counseling? And mm-hmm. they said no. And, you know, that's not their responsibility. But
there's no disclaimer or anything.
There's no disclaimer.
I feel like the more these stories come out, they act as the disclaimer. I mean, I wasn't a fan of these tests anyways, just because I don't know what a company's doing with my DNA information. But then to open Pandora's box, possibly, to shattering your family. I mean, that yeah. is another cautionary tale, I think. And then to have his own family be angry at him, I really hope that they find peace in this.
I feel the same way. The silver lining is he says he has six children and he's close with his kids.
Yay.
Because I was worried, you know, who does he have now? Everybody's yeah. turned against him. So who knows what the minutia is of what's really going on in any family and what could be causing the upset feelings on other levels. But I just think it's an interesting conversation. And if you're listening and you've been wanting to take one of these tests, maybe just mentally prepare yourself before you click on that button, just knowing that, you know, your family could be turned upside yeah. down.